This is Mark Strassman, reporter for Grid World. We're about to talk to Dr. Robert Cohen, who is a fellow of the Economic Strategy Institute and one of the leading experts in the area of grid computing, and we're very glad to have him here on Grid World today. Welcome to our show.
Thanks.
Why don't we start out by you just giving a little bit of the background about how you found your way to grid computing, which is such a new area. I'm certain when you were starting your career, you didn't think you'd be a grid computing expert. How did the two fields evolve? How did your career and the field evolve together?
Well, I was doing a lot of analysis of the growth of the internet, and one of the studies that was done about 4 years ago claimed that the internet would stop growing by about 2005 or 6, that the growth rate would drop to below 50% a year, and it was based on a lot of assumptions, including assumptions about what would happen with peer-to-peer and server-to-server traffic, and it seemed to me that assumptions that were made were really trying to ensure that people viewed both the consulting group that did the study and the brokerage house that was one of the sponsors of it were now taking a much more conservative view of the internet space as a result of the dot-com blowout. So I went back and revisited a lot of the assumptions and said if one made a little bit more generous assumptions, then the study included what would happen to internet bandwidth, and it turned out that if you expected about a 50% greater growth in peer-to-peer and server-to-server traffic, that internet bandwidth demand or use would turn around in about 2004 or 5 and start to go back over doubling a year, probably up to about 150% growth a year by 2006, 7, or 8. And I presented that study to one of the early grid forum, the Global Grid Forum meetings in Toronto about, I think, 3 years ago. So that got me involved with grids, and from there I did a study of the impact of grids on the state of North Carolina, and after that I put together a consortium through the Economic Strategy Institute to do a study of the impact of grids in the United States, which included a study of the impact of grids on the California economy.
Okay, now, before we deal with those specific studies, why don't we talk a little bit about the dynamics about what's involved here and why, essentially, with the in the areas of bandwidth, web services, and grid computing, and how they relate to each other and how all of them together relate to economic growth and why that's an important meeting point for all these concepts.
Okay, well, maybe I should start with the economic growth.
Right.
In terms of the economic growth, as we know in the United States, one of the main things that's driven economic growth is technological change.
Right.
And in this case, what's happened initially is that cluster computing, which is kind of the precursor to grids, where machines are linked using middleware primarily behind a firewall, what you're able to do
tell our audience the part of it that doesn't know it. What's middleware exactly?
Middleware is kind of a software that connects applications to an operating system.
Okay.
So in a sense, what the grid software is for the most part is the is not a new operating system. It's kind of riding on the operating system, and it sits between applications and the operating system.
Right. And it kind of manages the applications or coordinates the applications.
Coordinates the use and provides for some management capabilities and so forth, and for parallelizing of applications so that they can be cut up into different pieces.
Right.
So one of the major things that it's able to do is use the full processing power of each CPU. So many of the companies that are using the initial clusters are stringing together desktop PCs, just like one has in the SETI at Home or some of the anthrax studies and so forth that have been run, where people can actually sign up on the internet, download the software, and contribute their computer at home to the computations that are being done. But that's also happening within corporations, where they'll link up, you know, thousands or sometimes even tens of thousands of desktops to capture the compute power. And the initial economic benefit is that instead of needing to buy additional computers, each of which only gives you 15% of the total processing power, you've all of a sudden been able to capture this missing 80 to 85% of the processor capabilities. So in some of the cases I've talked to, like one large drug company, they're saving $2 million in 1 year by not having to buy additional computers.
So in a sense what it is there's a, I'm not sure how scientifically accurate it is, but it's often said that humans use 10-15% of their brains.
Right.
In fact, so do the CPUs. When they're the humans need to be gridified, so that
right.
So that all that would be used. And in fact, that's what grid computing does for the unused computing capacity in
right.
In computers.
But okay. For the economics of it, what's happening is that you're getting a huge cost savings. You're also creating the possibility that with this kind of compute capability, people are able to do a lot more work. You know, so for instance, one of the subsidiaries of Boeing that develops rocket engines was able to analyze the rocket engine designs in a day or two instead of 30 days. So
right.
Anybody who's, you know, doing that kind of work becomes far more productive. And what I've seen in a number of cases is fairly impressive productivity gains for companies. So these types of things really drive the economic benefits. And to deploy this new technology, what has happened in the economy is that there's spending that goes on to deploy clusters and grids and web services because of the great benefits that they offer. And so companies are starting to spend more on the software, on the systems integrators, on the computers, on communications equipment, and on access to communications services to support clustering grids and web services.
And all that takes a lot more bandwidth.
Well, it will take more bandwidth once there's much more use of true grids that
right.
go beyond the firewall. It's already taking more bandwidth as companies put more operations online that are using, say, a web services portal to do banking operations. So one of the large banks that I've talked to is using, you know, 20 gigabit backbone this year instead of 10 gigabits last year, and it's probably going to go up to 40 gig next year. And so, you know, you're having some businesses spending fairly appreciable amounts of money to increase the bandwidth that they're using, even though they're not doing kind of huge grid projects. Even in the early stages, we're beginning to see some of that spending. And what companies are saying is that as they graduate from using departmental grids or grids that are multi-departmental, or clusters that are multi-departmental, to where they're doing grids within a corporation so that they can link up various sites in the United States with sites in Europe and sites in Asia to really build almost a global grid,
right.
that will really use bandwidth, that there'll be almost a bandwidth jump sometime in probably 2005, 2006, 2007 that will appreciably increase the demand for bandwidth access.
Now is it data. It's not processing. The processing cycles don't go anywhere. They stay where they are.
The processing cycles can. One can start to grab processing cycles wherever you need them, or you can also, if you have a global grid.
Right.
One of the things that, say, a semiconductor platform wants to do is really reduce the time to complete a new design.
Right.
And if you have people working 8 hours a day in the United States, even though you span a few time zones, you're only going to get, you know, maybe 12 hours or 14 hours worth of work in the United States.
Right.
So if you want to work on something 24 hours a day so that you can essentially half the time it takes to get a new design, a new chip design completed.
Right.
If you set up centers all around the globe and have people able to essentially call on compute power that's in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia, and form one kind of huge virtual computer that any major, you know, design center can call on, you're going to essentially change the entire operations of the company. It becomes a global entity where any design person within the company can call on computational power wherever it's located, and maybe even surge computational power that you've contracted for. You know, if you say, okay, I think I'm going to need 2,000 CPUs, which with so much, you know, so many gigahertz, and all of a sudden you say, I need to double. For this project, to get this project done, I need to double my computational power. You could possibly call up, you know, an IBM, an HP, somebody else who offers on-demand capabilities when you have this grid in place and you contract for this and say, okay, for the next 5 hours, I'm going to need to double my computational power, and wherever they have computational power, they will make it available to you.
Okay, what are the kinds of problems besides chip design, the 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 most important problems that are being worked on this way, and which are the, well, let's do that first.
To kind of counter some of the information that's been in the trade press recently.
Right,
there was one article that I received that essentially said there was a survey of IT departments. Only 20% of them were thinking of developing a grids, and grids weren't having much of an impact. Or I've seen, you know, other people recently who said, you know, nobody in the pharmaceutical industry is using this kind of technology, their clusters or grids.
Is this like Thomas Watson Jr. saying there's only a market for 6 computers in the world?
Thomas Watson Jr. way underestimated
yes.
the kind of need for computational
right.
power. But I think what's happening today is that you can see from the economic argument I made earlier that there's this dramatic savings, but it also enhances the ability to address really big problems, like how do you design a car, how do you identify new drugs, and also some of the companies are starting to use this to kind of rapidly pull together critical or strategic information. So, you know, I want to see financial figures for each of my departments. I want to put them through these various types of analysis so I can find out, you know, where am I making money, where am I losing money, what things are really becoming more productive and really keeping on schedule if I'm hoping to get 3 or 4% productivity gains in my firm, and which ones are not.
Right, so with this kind of capability, you can both deal with more data and you can deal with it more frequently or faster, so you can
right.
essentially know where the company is making money and losing money almost right. on an instantaneous basis.
Right, and you can also then say, okay, here's the way I used to do business before. I would put it in a design group and it would then get sent out to, you know, say a partner that puts a drivetrain design together and a brake design and something like that. And how do I do that different now? And you could almost say, okay, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to link everybody up who contributes various parts of my design.
Right.
And I'm going to also identify what the costs of each of those things are.
Right.
So if I want to see what things I might be able to reduce in cost by maybe simplifying the design so I could use it across several different projects,
right.
you might be able to do that before the design is set in stone.
Right, so in fact, like, for example,
so what you do is you almost change the way, you change the basic business processes within the company.
Right. For example, with a car that say has 4,000 parts,
mm-hmm.
you can specify essentially the inputs and outputs and parameters and size for the drivetrain or the tire or the steering wheel or whatever, and then you can farm out the design and production of all those parts and know that as long as everyone's meeting the standards and they're meeting the input-output requirements, you can modularly switch them, and you can, in fact, offer your customers a chance to, you know, get an Italian steering wheel and a French tire or whatever you want to do, and then put it together through coordination that's also managed by this system.
Right, but what I'm trying to give you an example of is how do you skip from that, which
right.
is probably the way we would do business today, to something that's very different.
Okay,
so
what's...
for instance, let's say that the car becomes more a box of electronics and software.
Right.
And I give you software that regulates your engine. And I give you software that maybe you can use to change your GPS system or
right.
your emergency system, or that gets activated in case you have a crash and calls can identify where the nearest emergency group is or nearest hospital is.
Right, or programs the video for the kids in the back seat.
Right, programs the video for the kids in the back seat. And I start to work with various companies that provide that software so that it can now be developed. And also I start to work with my groups of, let's say, dealers and repair shops and maybe even my customers. So I start doing this thing, you know, I start running my business in a way that, you know, maybe I can look at, you know, can I develop a software that simplifies the way I run my drivetrain so that I can change the design. Instead of using 200 parts for the drivetrain, I can use 20.
Right.
And I redesign that. Or let's say if I'm a drug company, I can change the way I work with patients so that I can say, okay, now I know the human genome, I can develop a drug that works much better if you have, you know, certain genes in your background, and I can develop a test and send it out to you. So if you take the test, prick your arm, you will know which particular type of drug, A, B, C, or D, or which variant of a single drug that I develop is going to be more effective for you in terms of it'll work faster, it'll have fewer side effects, and, you know, maybe by doing that we'll start to get some of these drug costs and hospital costs under control.
In fact, it's the personalization that the Toffler's talked about with a vengeance, essentially.
Right. I mean, and this may change the way that companies can, you know, interact with their customers. They can interact with their partners, their research partners, their clinical trial partners. It can change a lot of the ways that business currently runs today that makes it seem very detached from consumers.
Okay, well, I'm more convinced than I was before that this is a great thing.
Okay. You wanted me to name like a few examples of where
right.
where is this really being used?
Right.
So, I mean, I could give you some good examples.
Go ahead.
One is some of the major auto companies are using this for their design efforts, where they're kind of linking up design centers that they have. Sometimes even trying to link them up with some of the supplier companies they work with to really enhance their ability to do design and to, you know, put everybody kind of on a network basis so that they start, you know, really sharing data that's integral to the company, and it becomes more of a kind of computerized, IT-rich environment that people work in. They're basically moving away from paper.
Right.
But these computations that are being used on a grid are very beneficial in terms of the cost savings, getting products done much quicker. I mean, one of the things that auto companies are trying to address is how do you design a new car in less and less time.
Right.
So this is a kind of a linchpin in addressing that. They're also deploying web services so that people can have, you know, web services would essentially be like applications behind an internet portal. You can get to the internet portal in a secure way so that you can use various secure access lines to a web service, whether it's behind the corporate firewall or outside of it. You can see what the results are from various projects, and it really facilitates collaboration and agility within the company. You have drug companies that are now linking together research centers using initially data grids, where they take data silos and basically put broadband connections that are secure between them so that research teams don't have to be specialized in a single location. They can be collaborative groups. You have aerospace design companies that are, you know, designing a new plane or a part of a plane. They can work with a partner that's outside their own company, set up a secure connection, work collaboratively on a project. They can send data to someplace like Singapore to do processing if it's costly to do it in Europe or the U.S. So that, you know, the compute power goes wherever you need to access it, and the data can be in various different locations. The whole idea is that you get the work done faster, you set up groups that collaborate much better, and you make both time gains, economic gains, and productivity gains. I've seen pharmaceutical companies that have linked together various disparate departments to work collaboratively on drug design and drug discovery, where there used to be a separate cluster in genomics, bioinformatics, cheminformatics, drug discovery. All of those clusters are now linked behind a single firewall in a large research center. They're now planning to like link centers like that together once they go to broadband links, and to also have a capability of tapping in to the human genome information that will come in from various sources, like whether it's NIH or the Human Genome Project, or, you know, various private companies that would keep it. There will be a way to access huge databases that will then come into play in terms of how do I develop a drug to cure intestinal cancer, or how do I develop a drug to fight the Asian flu.
Okay, two things that people are worried about that are outsourcing and privacy compromises. From what you're saying here, essentially the work project is now distributed globally, mm-hmm. and when humans are needed, they can also presumably be hired where they're where you get the best cost to benefit ratio, where you're going to get the most intelligent people working the hardest for the least money, and that often means outside the United States.
Well, there is a bit of a difference here. I mean, okay. It doesn't mean you can outsource everything. I think some of the locations where you have these operations on the grid are ones where you're going to need an environment that has lots of support for both the computer technology, the kind of discipline that's addressing this issue, like life sciences, you know, biologists or medical specialists, and you're going to need the infrastructure for the communications, and it's going to have to be relatively, you know, competitively priced.
Right.
So you won't pay for a real expensive connection if that's the only thing that's available. So things won't be outsourced, and you also have to have the skills. And I think what's significant in the U.S. is that both the U.S. research centers and a lot of the companies that are using this technology have been at the leading edge of this. So, I mean, one of the things where you will see outsourcing is where a company wants to become kind of a 24-hour day operation. But that, you know, one of the benefits of doing that is that they should become more competitive, they should become more profitable, And a lot of that would then go back into building up the capability in the U.S. So, I mean, I don't see this as being something where if you develop these kind of capabilities, all of a sudden you're going to want to do all your chip design in Asia.
Right.
I mean, that's not how you're setting this thing up. You're setting it up so you run it 24 hours a day. It may mean that some of the chip companies, as they have, will pay for a new design center in China or India or, you know, somewhere else in Asia so that they have this capability. But I think the thing that's interesting here is that this also suggests that the way in which the economy is going to move, if this is that beneficial, will be that places that develop the computer skills within their workforces and people who have the kind of cross-disciplinary skills of being a life scientist but knowing about computer science, or being an MBA and knowing about, you know, computer science, and being able to link, you know, those disciplines to join things together will really make areas more competitive. In fact, when I did the studies in North Carolina and California, I even found firms that had located in those states because they felt they could find people with skills that covered both disciplines, both computing and biology, or both semiconductor design and communications skills.
Right. So all of this speaks to the integration, if not the being subsumed of many or most of these technical disciplines within computer science, or a kind of integration of computer science and genomics or industrial design.
It also suggests, and I mean, one of the things that I did in the North Carolina study was to look at some very traditional industries.
Right.
And I mean, that's up on the website www.e-nc.org. The North Carolina study's there. It's also on the Global Grid Forum site, ggf.org. One of the things that pointed out was that there's almost like a waterfall effect, that the companies at the top that are developing grids, clusters, and web services are kind of at the cutting edge. The next level down that they work with is being asked to develop more computer skills, get into clustering, and so forth. And then you start finding companies like that sell to Gap or to Walmart and so forth. And the bigger companies have web services in place. They'll probably be developing grids in the near future. But the smaller suppliers, or even middle-sized suppliers, are being asked to become, you know, computer literate, more computer skilled, have good internet connections, really become more savvy than they used to, or use some sort of a middleman who takes their orders and translates them, you know, into something that can be read by XML and put into a supply chain system that is totally, you know, Java-based.
Well, speaking of all of that, now Walmart says in 2 years everything has to be RFID identified when they're going to get shipped in,
right?
And presumably soon every last product will need to be, when it gets cheap enough, every product will be RFID mm-hmm. identified. So you then have the integration from the piece of gum up mm-hmm. up to the financial strategic planning
right.
paradigm.
Well, that's
all integrated in the chain there.
Right, but that's kind of what's happening with the grids and web services, that you'll have to, you know, become much more, I mean, that the RFID you can do just by putting a label on the chain. It doesn't necessarily mean that the smaller companies will need to do the computational
right.
analysis that the bigger companies will need to do, so they know where all the packages are traveling. The in the grid realm, I mean, it's reaching down into what you might consider the mom and pop operation, and also into things like, you know, auto dealers who are getting notes from a big three company saying to them, you know, we want you to be on at least a 384 kilobit per second connection by X date, Otherwise, you can't be a dealer anymore.
Right. Is that, so, does that happen? That kind of thing?
Happened last summer.
Oh, and what was...
Well, I mean, you need to get that kind of connection, otherwise you're no longer a dealer.
Right, okay.
And so there's kind of, you know, the bar is being raised.
Right.
And one of the issues is, can we make, you know, particularly in areas that aren't really connected very well and don't really have these kind of skills, you know, in North Carolina, the state's got an initiative to try to connect up these dealerships and build the skills in some of these smaller, you know, even mom-and-pop type companies so they can, you know, remain competitive.
So what is your view, that they will be able to remain competitive, or that we'll end up with...
I think where you'll have this kind of skill building and assistance in terms of promoting, you know, higher speed access at reasonable prices, that will happen. I think it could be a fairly uneven pattern. There may be some instances where some people just get dropped off. I mean, if you look at some of the forecasts of how many, you know, second or third level suppliers to the big three will exist in 2 or 3 years, the numbers don't go up. They go down pretty dramatically. So, you know, I think there's likely to be a consolidation, and the people that are going to survive are the ones that manage to get these skills.
And what about the ones who don't survive? What happens to the society in which the people who are on the grid are doing okay?
I think this is one of the challenges, that what we have here is a real way of helping society become more productive, helping a lot of the companies become more competitive, more profitable, and so forth. And yet, I don't think the society has recognized that we're almost on the verge of a new industrial revolution, that grids really, embody and will be the driver of.
Because I have to say, I've been listening pretty closely to the Democratic candidates argue who should run for president against President Bush, and I haven't heard grid computing come up yet.
No, I don't think that in the policy world there's any recognition of this whatsoever, with maybe one or two exceptions.
And does that extend also to governments themselves at local, state, or the federal level?
No, there are some governments that have gotten much more active in this.
Which ones have, or if you can name them? Or the
types? I mean, North Carolina has. There's a whole grid initiative going on there.
Right.
I think a couple of other states, like Louisiana, are a little bit more cognizant of this. And then states that have big operations that, you know, mostly academic, but also a fair number of corporations, like California, I think, are much more aware. Illinois, where you have Argonne, there's much more going on.
Do you see much of a role for, let's say, state governments who wouldn't know a grid if it hit them in the budget?
Well, they don't have that much money, but I mean, they are trying. You know, like in the case of North Carolina, there's a center that's been set up. The E-NC group in Raleigh that's promoting better access to the internet, various programs to help corporations, and even training efforts, and just making the grid more available. There's a statewide grid initiative to put the North Carolina grid in place and link up the various universities so that various, you know, research results can be shared, and people can start to collaborate, use this, gain skills, know how it works. People within the schools will use it. I mean, we're going to have to generate the skills for this. And, you know, I was just at a conference last week. We had people there from Beijing. The Chinese government is putting all its health information on a grid. It's putting all of its, you know, social service information on a grid. It recognizes that this is something that's important for economic development and for creating the kind of skills in the society that they will need in the next 10, 20 years.
Now, you've mainly been talking about hooking up academic and big corporations in grids.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is there an economic value to hooking up millions or even tens of thousands of individual PCs running Pentium 3s or whatever?
Well, we've seen some of that already. I mean, well, you have SETI at home where people sign up, download the software, and, you know, their computer is used in terms of the search for extraterrestrial life.
Right.
We have these projects that Intel has set up with United Devices and Cambridge University where they've done research that, you know, has been DOD sponsored to look at, you know, how to identify various types of anthrax and what might be some drugs that could be used to treat anthrax.
Okay, to take a more specific example, California, for example, has a $10-15 billion deficit right
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
It also has tens of millions of personal computers sitting around. Now, would it make any sense, and is it technically feasible to give the proper software to 10 million computer users in California and have them pool their computing capacity and let the state of California use it so it doesn't have to spend more money on
I mean,
new computers?
There was some way, if they wanted to, like, calculate, you know, the returns that could be that should be sent out to everybody that's filled in their tax returns, and there was a way to break it up so that it could be secure and, you know, somebody couldn't hack in and find out an individual taxpayer's information,
right.
Or if there were some other programs that they do, like, I don't know, earthquake monitoring, where they're paying an outside contractor, where some of the processing is done overnight, or they keep computers, you know, kind of sitting around and maybe run them every 2 weeks and then they shut them down.
Or let's say, for example, elections that are run every 2 years.
Well, I don't know whether people would want to have the election done through their desktop PCs.
Yeah,
there might be some concerns about that, but problems that could be, you know, like say there's an earthquake detection study that's being done and you're basically contracting out because there's a lot of data that's being analyzed and the state's paying, I don't know, say a few million dollars or whatever. They're trying to save money. They could say, okay, you know, help out the state of California. We have this earthquake thing. We're going to go to whatever vendor it is and, you know, they're going to develop a way we can put this earthquake data that we'd otherwise be paying whatever, you know, several million dollars.
In fact, that's not hypothetical. The USGS in California is doing lots of research on earthquake modeling.
And you could do that today.
Okay. What's the Globus project, and how does it fit into that kind of thing?
Globus has been developing essentially the toolkit that's used to create a lot of the middleware for grids and clusters.
So is there a standard piece of software that goes on
things
like SETI?
Yeah, most of the middleware that's being used has used Globus or some of the other, you know, early projects that developed middleware. I mean, it's not the only thing that's out there, but it's become one of the most popular. There's a lot of work being done on it. It's the other thing that's going to happen with it. It's going to essentially consolidate with web services standards. So we're moving towards an era of grid services in the next couple of years.
Okay, say a little bit more about that, what grid services is or will be?
It's essentially a combination of grid computing and web services.
And so then people will be able to go out and get things done for themselves, whether they're companies or individuals.
Right, and it's really kind of putting things under a single roof and making the standards development more integrated between the web services, you know, the various applications and capabilities that could be easily called for, and the basic grid computing applications to some extent, because it's probably easier to create a lot of the security capabilities through a web services side than it is through the Globus toolkit.
Okay.
What it is, you know, we've had kind of two different tracks evolving, and the two of them will come together as a single thing, and there's been work mostly on Globus, but Globus has now been incorporating more and more of the web services technology.
Okay, now say something about the administration or the management of this. This is a sharing kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering whether it that means that the institutions that are going to manage these grids are likely to be more collective than is presently the case in a lot of computing, or whether major corporations will own and operate them, or whether they'll be owned and operated by the users at the other extreme of that continuum.
Well, what's happening at this point, particularly in the grid area, is that you have two choices. One is to build and the other is to outsource. And the outsource would be that you basically contract with one of the grid software and service vendors to do the whole grid for you. You don't buy the machines. They have all the computational power. They create the broadband connectivity so you can access that whenever you need it. They may even create surge power so if you usually need, X amount of processing power and you need to surge that to 2x, that you're contracted to do that.
Who are the big companies in that space?
Well, the main big player is IBM in the grid space, but I mean HP is also fairly active. Sun has a grid computing effort. I mean, does, and a number of these have different names,
right.
but they're mostly kind of either outsourcing or some kind of more encompassing grid initiative.
So you can go to Sun or IBM or HP and say, I need this much capacity.
Well, I'd like to set up a grid. I'd like to outsource it to you,
right.
You come in and do the whole thing and bring in a...
They'll do it with your computers, or they'll make it available. In other words,
your computers could then tap into the...
Right.
But you won't have to buy all the processing power and the middleware, and they will do... make a lot of the applications run on the grid and also on your own computer, so you can adapt, say, design applications that you use so they will work on the grid.
Right, and they'll also make use of your... Let's say you've got a lot of computers in your company or your city,
mm-hmm.
but you don't have the expertise or the interest in doing it. You could then make a contract with one of those companies that you mentioned to set up your computers as source of power as well as users of it, and they would handle the setting up of the putting the hardware up and putting
the
software on
all the computers. Yeah, I think most of the compute power goes, in those cases, outside the firm, but there are other firms that are probably more concerned about security, at least at this stage.
Right.
And so many of them, particularly in the pharmaceutical or semiconductor area, are building things internally.
Right.
And not contracting out.
Okay.
And so, there's kind of a second model. And there are companies that specialize in, say, building clusters for specific types of companies.
Right.
Like, Avaki mainly sells to the life science industry. Data Synapse largely sells to financial services.
Is the economics of this of grid computing such that it would make sense for one of those companies or a new one to go out and sign people up to use their computing power and then pay them a certain amount and then charge slightly more than they're paying out and paying for the middleware and the support to clients? Is there a company on that model yet?
That's kind of
like SETI for hire.
Hmm?
Like SETI, but for hire, where the people, instead of volunteering, would get paid and instead of giving away.
Oh, yeah, there's companies that do that. I mean, United Devices is probably the best example of that.
Right.
And they're out there. I mean, the other thing that this has done, which most people don't realize, is that it's also for companies that develop processors like Intel.
Right.
It's kind of raised a whole new frontier in terms of thinking, I used to build processors to run computers and, have an operating system and work with some kind of applications. And I could sell a computer and people could load on the software and so forth. And now they're thinking about, if grids become essentially the de facto infrastructure of every U.S. company within the next 3 or 4 years, what should my processor be able to do?
Right.
Perhaps it should be able to link into a grid and, identify when it's got, or even set up the grid.
Sure.
And maybe even my processor includes some of the middleware, some of the things that need to talk to the middleware. and invoke. So, you know, this, it's not just changing the companies that use it, it's also beginning to change the industries that develop products for computers. It's making companies that sell network equipment like a Juniper or a Nortel or a Lucent begin to think, you know, if networks like, you know, AT&T or Sprint or MCI or Verizon or SBC have to carry really, really big files for corporations instead of, you know, aggregated email files, and these files are going to have hundreds of gigabytes or maybe hundreds of terabytes or maybe even petabytes. How am I going to identify them? How do I treat them differently? How do I set up the grid? How do I, you know, let a company that's going to buy, you know, maybe provide these services like an AT&T or like a Quest or an SBC or Verizon or MCI, how do they begin to change their operations so if this becomes a major part of their data services, they operate differently? What can they add that's a value, a new value that makes them operate in this space that gives them a way of adding something to the whole economy through the development of these grids? So it's transforming the kind of processors we build, the kind of network equipment we build, the kind of communication, you know, the telcos that we have, and it's kind of upsetting the apple cart, which is why I say it's kind of a real industrial revolution in the making.
It's a classic disruptive technology.
Very well, not just disruptive, but transformative.
Transformative, right.
Because if you begin to look at the capabilities that this gives, you know, both companies and individuals, I mean, you know, lots of things that didn't seem possible before because they were way too expensive to do. You know, like, I want to be able to see every medical test that I've ever had. So if I'm going to somebody tomorrow, I can take them the, you know, the last few x-rays I've got, and, you know, they, if they want to access my site, you know, and I give them permission, we can, you know, send my stuff out to some service. It can analyze them all. It can analyze all my blood tests. We can take it in. They can see whatever kind of videos they want to see, and this can all be put together so I can bring it to my doctor tomorrow or tell them where it is on the web. We can't do that right now. And, you know, if we could do it at low cost, or if companies could do some kind of synthetic work like this at very, very low cost, then it would really start to change things.
I can see that.
You know, it would change social services. It would bring down, you know, one of the things that's come out in the studies that I've done is that this would really reduce prices for products in a lot of the industries that are early adopters. So cars would be cheaper. Drugs would be cheaper. Planes would be cheaper to produce.
Although living in L.A., overall, making cars cheaper might not be the best thing
to
do. one or two things. So when Scott McNeely said 20 years ago, the network is the computer, now we can say the grid is the computer and see where that takes us, I guess.
Or maybe the grid is the system or something like that.
Right.
I'm not sure whether we have to be so computer-centric, because
okay,
one could run a grid on a, you know, any device that would connect with a landline, Wi-Fi, whatever kind of connection you want.
Well, right. And from just taking it a little further, what you were talking about, what AT&T does and what Intel does and so on, essentially this makes possible the reimagination of the relationships between the semiconductor industry and the telecommunications industry and a lot of other industries
that
essentially become part of the same project now.
Yeah,
in a closer way.
Right. It cuts across quite a number of industries and technologies, and is likely to force them to change the way they develop products and provide services. I mean, it's really what we're probably talking about in the next 3 or 4 years is that you're going to change the way a lot of business processes take place, the way a lot of services get delivered, and begin to change kind of the productivity in the economy. I mean, I'm an economist. I kind of feel that we're probably going to see much higher productivity numbers than most people would expect once this really starts to cut in.
Now, what about the international implications of this? Is there going to be? Is this going to drive Asia, Europe, and the United States closer together, further apart? Are they going to compete? Are they going to cooperate? Are they going to hook up in one big grid? What's the international aspect of all
this?
Well,
right now, what we're seeing is a lot of various regional groupings with grid initiatives. Like there's a, you know, nearly $1 billion initiative in Europe to build the science capabilities and support collaborations in this general area, both in terms of, you know, the grid technology itself, the applications, enhancing the middleware, building bigger network connections between science centers and, you know, creating a better infrastructure. We're seeing a similar initiative that's been in place for about the last 3 years in Japan, new spending in China. So, I mean, there's kind of a recognition at the national level that this is, you know, a key new technology, not just a toy, and that the skills really need to be developed now, because, you know, 5 to 10 to 20 years down the road, this will be kind of fundamental to the way the economy operates, and that research and analysis is done. Maybe even the way services are created and delivered.
Now, but is it competitive, or will it be cooperative?
Well, right now, I think it's been fairly competitive, although a lot of the people from, you know, there's a lot of exchange between Europe, Asia, and the U.S. I mean, people come to meetings together, they work together on Globus developments, they're working on standards groups through the Global Grid Forum. I think a lot of this will bring the scientific community closer together. I think it'll mean that there's more collaboration between business partners, and I would hope that it's, you know, particularly since it can also do a lot of social good. I mean, bringing people into a world where these kind of capabilities are there, that it could, in, you know, kind of help solve a lot of health problems, social problems, and so forth. I mean, it may take time before those capabilities are there, but, I mean, I think it's got the potential to do that and to, you know, maybe create a world where, you know, you don't have kind of a real global digital divide. Because one of the other things that this would do is probably make it much cheaper to access the kind of computer and communications capabilities that would be very meaningful, you know, in terms of having high-speed access to the internet, having access to very large stores of data that could be used for, you know, socially beneficial purposes as well as for business.
Okay, two points on that. One, it's long been argued, but principally within the scientific community, that the international scientific community can perform service by being a role model for international cooperation and so on and so forth. From what, also, technology is in many ways more international than governments.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering whether with the Asians and North Americans and Europeans building grids, which the natural tendency of which are to aggregate themselves, it seems to me, and there's probably a lot of broadband capacity from Global Crossing that's left over that's not being used.
Various people have global capacity for broadband. No, but I think the other thing is that a lot of the developments that you see are really to, instead of let people stay and kind of be behind a protective wall, to build more collaboration, and the fact that companies will operate more collaboratively maybe something that suggests we could have more collaboration
right
across national boundaries.
Well, what I'm arguing is if the science goes to the technology, goes to the business, and integrates those three the trilateral parts of the world there, so that they are integrated, and we've already mentioned that governments are not leading early adopters of these kind of things.
Right.
That maybe in some sense the techno-scientific commercial community can supersede to a larger extent, although they don't have armies and weapons, but they do have a lot of activity that goes on, that in some way they can then let that percolate up into the government and social sphere and create more integration that way. Is that a possibility?
I think it's possible. I mean, the other thing that kind of strikes you in looking at the people that are working on this is that there's, you know, if you looked at the world 10 or 20 years ago, one of the ways of, you know, kind of protecting your economic interests was you set up standards that were totally incompatible between, you know, the U.S., Europe, and Japan.
Yeah, but,
say for TVs or for drug standards or something like that. The groups that have been promoting this are kind of open standard, you know, interoperability, and so particularly in these international groups, there's a feeling that, you know, the way you really advance these technologies is by opening them up, and you know, people can develop applications that are written to these open standards, but the openness of the technologies and the willingness to kind of share in their development, collaborate, are significant. And so I think that that begins to, even if it may only be in the scientific community, that it begins to change the mindset a little bit. I don't know if you can generalize from that and say, you know, if the scientists can start to collaborate, everybody else can have, you know, much more equal relationships, and
right,
a lot of the global conflict will disappear.
Right, well,
I think that's quite a jump.
Right, okay,
but,
well,
I mean, perhaps this suggests that if we can make capabilities that, you know, one had, you know, many people had probably argued in the past would create a digital divide, and if that digital divide can kind of be overcome,
well, that was my next.
Then maybe that suggests that you can develop a, you know, more of an environment where there would be access to these skills, access to these capabilities. But I think that one of the things I am concerned about is the fact that this is happening at kind of a scientific and a business level, and the policy area usually, you know, falls in a bit later, and there's not the kind of recognition that this is coming down the pike, even though it's been around.
Well, I'm trying to stand in the middle of the pike with a big sign that says grid computing is coming on it,
right,
to see what kind of effect that has.
You probably like somebody, you know, standing out there saying, you know, Jesus is coming tomorrow, or, you know, salvation is here tomorrow, and nobody's going to believe you.
Right.
So, I mean, until this really starts to be more apparent, you know, nobody's going to think that the Messiah has arrived.
Right.
You know, I'm not claiming that this is the Messiah either.
Right.
But I think that it changes a lot of the technical and economic context for the way we move forward in the next decade or two.
I think you're right. One last point and then one last question.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems then if Asia, North America, and Europe get their individual or collective acts together around grid computing and generate
mm-hmm.
a real powerful system, that the lesser developed countries in the world, lesser developed continents in the world, can essentially tap into that computing capacity given enough bandwidth to access it and use it for education and medical and industry and commercial development and so on.
Right.
So, and according to, I don't want to exactly go through, cite him as a source here, Trotsky's theory of uneven development said that once something's been done in one country, it doesn't have to be reinvented in another. And in this case, it would be the grid and the capabilities that it generates, so that they could be used in with wireless capability, for example, in villages, and people wouldn't have to come to the big city in order to become unemployed and so on, and a lot more could be accomplished that way, it seems to me.
I think one of the benefits of this is that it means that people can stay where they are
exactly, and
access the kind of
right,
skills that they need, so that one, you know, that's one of the benefits. One of the issues is, you know, are there going to be efforts to kind of develop these skills, to recognize what they offer, and will, you know, companies that, you know, now mainly operate in Europe, Asia, and the U.S. begin to use these same capabilities in Latin America more widely, you know, and there are, if you look at the academic collaborations, like on the data grid that's being set up for the physics grid, you'll see that there's a wide number of countries, including countries in developed areas or developing areas of the world. Like there's a big scientific community in Brazil, and I think in North Africa and South Africa, in a lot of the developing countries in Asia, not just Japan and China, that are all linked into CERN and doing physics work there and becoming very familiar with grids. So, you know, if that is kind of the early cutting edge of this technology, I think there's real possibilities that it would become more pervasive, especially as it emerges and has the potential to become kind of the de facto infrastructure for a lot of the business and probably, you know, government and social world.
In fact, what you just said as a model, which came from what I said about people having to migrate from villages into big cities, I live in a place called Valley Village, which is a little village, and people migrate here every day to downtown Los Angeles, and, mm-hmm. and they're stuck in gridlock every day, and it makes me think it's either on the grid or gridlock is the choice that exists in the industrial world, not just in the less developed world.
Well, there have been some, you know, initiatives in the U.S., particularly in California and in Europe, to do distance work.
Right.
You know, remote work,
telecommuting,
telecommuting, and things like that. So, I mean, this could probably enhance that.
Exactly.
Because you wouldn't have to have all the data at your location. You wouldn't have to have all the compute power at your location. You just have to be able to link into it. So, it might create a whole new context for how people work and, you know, the tapping into skills from various locations. And, you know, we've seen some of that in these collaborate or, you know, some kind of social effort, like, you know, there was a French effort to do cancer research where I think over a million people contributed their PC power to that. There have been efforts on anthrax where many people in the U.S. contributed their their PCs to that. So, you know, there's that kind of a recognition that this might lead to something much more, you know, constructive, and, you know, it's not a big deal to leave your computer online and let the project tap into your power and make a contribution of your CPU processing power to help solve, you know, how do we treat anthrax, or can we find extraterrestrial life, or can we solve a problem that might come up with a drug for cancer?
Well, in fact, Gerald K. O'Neill wrote a book in 1981 called 2081, in which people travel all over the world by staying home and having holograms mm-hmm. in their house, and with enough bandwidth and enough compute power, once someone works out the algorithms, they can have their meetings that way. Last question: what are you working on now? What kind of questions are you trying to answer? What kind of projects are you pursuing?
Well, I'm trying to do the final stages of the analysis of what's happening with the impact of grids in the U.S. But I'm also hoping to start a study to look at the impact of grids in Japan and possibly in Europe. And one of the things I'm hoping to look at a bit more, particularly in the U.S., is to look at how grids will affect business process changes and also demand for broadband access as they really get deployed much more widely.
Okay, so overall, would you say this is a pretty promising area to be involved in the next few years?
I would think so. I mean, I think for some of the early companies selling grid products, it's not been the biggest growth area. There hasn't really been kind of a real grid boomlet yet, but I think that it's got the potential to really stimulate a lot of productive growth and new products and significant efficiencies and productivity gains in business, and maybe some very important social benefits for the population.
The technical issues are not really an issue. It works.
There's still some issues, and we haven't covered them in much detail here.
Right.
I mean, I think there are a lot of security issues that still need to be addressed well. There's issues about, you know, how do these things work on networks? Can the networks really handle them? What's it going to cost? How effective will grids be in, you know, not only handling computational problems, but doing other business, addressing other business needs? You know, how much time will it take to adapt a lot of traditional applications so that they run on grids, and what's the cost of that, and how long will it take? Or will there be companies that will emerge that will really simplify kind of gridifying applications that are currently used so they can easily run on a grid without a large investment? And, you know, various issues like that, and many of the standards still haven't been set. The web services standards are still very open, and, you know, there are various vendors. There's the issue of, you know, which things will be really interoperable with each other, or if you buy one vendor's products for web services, will they kind of lock you in to having certain performance capabilities and not give you others? So, I mean, the area is still developing. There's still a lot of people saying that this, you know, really isn't anything that's going to have a big impact. So I'm probably, you know, one of the few that can maybe give you chapter and verse on how it is being used.
Right.
But, you know, one of the fascinating things about this is that it is possible in some of the industries to find thought leaders who you can sit down with and say, you know, how are you going to use this between now and the year 2010? And they've actually thought through how this is going to change their industry, how they're going to evolve it over time, regardless of whether they build it internally or outsource it. So, you know, when you start having people thinking like that about this, you know that, you know, this isn't just a flash in the pan. This is something that people have paid a lot of attention to and devoted considerable energy to trying to figure out how it's going to reshape the way they do business. And, you know, when you get to the people like that, they really can give you examples of how this is going to almost transform the way their business is operating in the economy, and how it's interacting with consumers and other parts of the economy, like how a drug company will interact with doctors or with hospitals. So I think it's fascinating to see how this is progressing, and I'd love to have some more companies that might be interested in this support the work to really look at what this is going to mean in the next few years, because I think it's that there is tremendous potential for change.
Well, I'm going to invite them all to GridWorld so they can hear you and the other people we've been interviewing and get the message.
That would be great.
Thanks very much for talking to us on GridWorld, and good luck on all this. And don't hang up, but I'm going to turn off the
recording. All right, and people, if they need to contact me, can contact me through the Economic Strategy Institute website.
I'm going to put a link to it at the right near this link. So
okay.
Don't hang up, but thanks again, and good luck with all this.
Great.